Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway. Mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
You are listening to UPRN 107.9, New Orleans.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis Radio Show. It's Saturday night. That's right. Straight out of Florida. And, Diesel, I forgot. What state are you in?
Indiana.
Indiana. Yeah, that's right. Straight out of Indiana. And then, what's that weird noise?
Sounds like, space.
I don't know. Mike, are you in a car? I don't know. Where did that noise come from?
I don't know.
Sounds like a car window. But, uh-oh. I heard an echo. All right, well, tonight's guest is Micah Hanks, and we're going to talk.
Hello?
Hello? Greetings, sir.
Hello? What happened?
Hello?
Well, it's aliens, right?
Right.
They always like
I
to say...
I heard a weird static noise, and then we dropped, I guess. But tonight's guest is Micah Hanks, and we'll be discussing his new book, The UFO Singularity, and also another book of his, The Reynolds Mansion, An Invitation to the Past, The History and Strange Happenings at a Southern Antebellum Home. And briefly, it's been raining for like 3 or 4 days in Florida, and it sucks, and it's humid and disgusting.
Is it those big fat drops?
Yeah, it's just gross. It's nonsense. nonstop rain, and I'm sweating, and humidity, and it's like 1 minute it's cold, the next minute it's hot, and now the hot's coming, so I guess it's going to start getting hot in Florida, like, all the time now, which I hate.
Yeah. It's still pretty cold over here, man.
You're lucky. You're lucky that you're in the cold. I hope we get a couple more cold spells, at least here. Been in the 30s. That's about as low as it's gotten in Florida, the 30s, which I guess that's sort of cold so for some places, but not really. But, what else? Oh, next Saturday, Jim Mars. That's right. Jim Mars is going to be on the show. Jerry Avalos will be co-hosting. And also Andy Colvin, Mothman photographer, is going to be sitting in. So we're going to have like a round table with Jim Mars. So how groovy is that? And what else? Let me look. Oh, hold on. Let me pull up my calendar thing. Scott Allen Roberts on the 9th, and if everything goes as planned, Michael will be co-hosting. He'll return on the 9th. That's right. That's still looking good, Micah?
Oh, of course. I wouldn't let you down.
All right. Got my eye on you, man.
Muffin man.
And then on the 16th, the Artie Six Killer, we're going to be talking about American Indian Star People stories. Andy Colvin's going to co-host with that. The 23rd, Audrey Starborn, Michael Jaggers, you know, the dude from high school, my friend from Walking Dead, is going to be co-hosting with that. Awesome. Then on the 30th, Christopher Noel, going to be who's going to be co-host? Oh, Andy Colvin. And then just a couple more from April, Thunder White Cloud, and he's going to be talking about Holodium Labs and EMF technology and microwave technology and basically the death of Fred Bale, who was a friend of his who died on the conspiracy theory episode of conspiracy theory on the death ray episode. So wow. He's friends with Fred Bale, and he's possibly going to bring Sean Stone on with him. He says we'll see what happens with that. So no promises, but that would be awesome if Oliver Stone's son comes on the show on the 6th, on April 6th. But it was weird because I called Thunder White Cloud and I said, I was joking around about, you know, them zapping you. You know, the government zaps you with drones and microwave technology and voice of God weapons and stuff. He goes, did you say zap? And I go, yeah. I said zap. He goes, well, do you want to talk to Zap from American Gladiator? What? I guess. He put me on the phone. She goes, who's this? And I'm like, Jeffrey Pritchett, blah, 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 blah. And it was her from American Gladiator, that zap chick. So that was kind of weird.
What are you guys talk about, man?
We didn't talk that long. It was just kind of, hey, how are you? What do you do? And I told her I was just getting to know at Thunder, and it wasn't that long of a conversation. It was just kind of strange, you know.
That's something I was talking.
Yeah, I was talking to that from American Gladiator. And then who else? Ken Gerhard on the 13th of April. That's it for now. I'll tell you the others later. But he's got a new book about Mothman, winged, weird creatures. And Beasel will be coming back in April, full force. What are you doing in March? He's going to Sweden. He's going to some festival.
I'm going to hang out with Helga and Heidi and go to the Black Metal Festival.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's like, what kind of bands are there?
All kinds. Ooh, I mean, it's like black Norwegian metal.
Nice. Like, don't do too much smack while you're there.
I'll try.
I'm just kidding.
I'll try.
I've been to weird concerts like that, Chimera and stuff, and hard stuff like that. Yeah.
I'm really not going to Sweden though.
Yeah, but no Sweden.
But to a metal festival, so.
Yeah, I haven't been to a concert. Who's the last concert I went to? I don't remember. Man, I've been to so many. It's been a while, though.
My birthday's coming up, and then I'm going on some investigations and to a couple other festivals.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
What day is that?
March 30th.
Cool. Well, happy birthday. All right. Well, let's get to our guest. It's been a long week, been a long couple of weeks. Everybody I talk to has got weird stuff happening to them, like medical stuff. Like, I got a lot of medical stuff going on. Like, I found out I might have diabetes. My blood sugar's been high, so that sucks. It's been like 138 and 160 and crap, so I guess I got to go to a doctor now, which I hate to do. So I might have the big diabetes. Yeah. So they're just going to tell me to quit, lose some weight and all that stuff. So we'll see what happens. But my blood sugar's been high. So, and everybody else I talk to is like weird medical stuff. Mm-hmm. So the chemtrails, man. That's right.
Chemtrails.
Them damn chemtrails. Well, let's get to Mr. Hanks. Muffin Man, Mr. Hanks.
How's it going, guys? You doing okay?
I'm doing well.
No, I'm not, but I'm gonna pretend I am.
everything I've heard you say in here actually indicates to me, Jeffrey, that you're not doing well. But you know, I'm sincerely hoping that your condition improves sooner rather than later. You know?
Yeah, that's fine.
Fortunately, I seem to be in fairly good health, and I've seen no chemtrails over my house today, at very least.
So, Micah, this is like your fourth or fifth time on the show, isn't it?
It's a shame, isn't it? I know.
You have to
do with my time, right? No, I'm kidding. Hell, I always look forward to being with you, man. It's a good time.
You have the most appearances ever as a guest, I think. I'm just historically bringing that up as a historical
really? Really? Have I been
on?
Wow, that's really cool. Actually, now I'm going to turn that frown upside down and make it into a full-blown straight out honor. So yeah, I'm very glad to be the most guested here on the Mavis show.
Right. And you're going to be a co-host.
I know, right? Seriously. Yeah. That's the first perk of the Five Timers Club. Once you enter the Five Timers Club, you get to be a co-host. So be the one
that happens.
Andy Colvin's been on a lot too, so I'm not sure, but you're up there and he's up there. You two are the most for sure. He's co-hosted a lot. But, go ahead,
Beazle. I was just going to say, just wait to see what happens at number 7, you know.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Jeff shows up on my front porch.
I'll wax you.
That's right.
I'm just kidding. I don't want to wax you. But, all right. Well, you've been making the rounds about this UFO singularity. Why are past unexplained phenomenon changing our future? Where will transcending the bounds of current thinking lead? How near is a singularity? So tell us, what exactly is the UFO singularity? What do you mean by that? I mean, we all know what a UFO is, and I've heard of singularity, but the two together is kind of a unique thing. So what do you mean by that?
It is a unique thing, a strange pairing, but a match made in heaven, as I think your listeners will soon see. The whole entire premise here is essentially this. We look at UFO technology, and we appear to be dealing with something that we can't explain, and which seems to be a variety of technology that is far beyond what we know to exist, at least on a conventional level, you know, civilian level and whatnot. And of course, with my premise, I don't rule out the possibility that there are highly advanced governmental technologies and maybe other things out there that wouldn't necessarily have to be extraterrestrial aliens, but sure. Within the context of looking at UFO phenomenon and how I've basically defined that as some inexplicable technological presence that apparently is capable of exceeding known levels of technology accessible to humans today. When we take a step away and we look at something which most would think is entirely different, technological singularity, to define that concisely, we could call that essentially the creation or the advent of intelligence that exceeds intelligence, likely through technology in the coming decades. And so ideally how that would be achieved would be one of two ways. It would either be through the creation of an artificial form of intelligence, or it would be through the utilization of some technology that would allow man and machine to emerge. That would be, in a sense, I think, a form of artificial intelligence just as well, but it would be different in the sense that we actually merge with a machine and supplement natural level principles of human intelligence as opposed to creating a system that can think.
But all that to say, when we're talking about an intelligence or a technology that appears to be, you know, a few steps ahead of what we are right now, we all, the futurists among us, would tend to look at singularity and say, it's coming, singularity's near, it's going to be here. You look at UFO technology and you say, if you don't discount outright, as much of mainstream academia and the media already does, if you don't discount the possibility that UFOs are an advanced intelligence of some sort, of some variety, in our midst, that obviously shows that there is, in our very midst already today, some variety of technology that exceeds what may be natural levels of human intelligence on some levels, whether those be perceptual or via some sheer technology as yet unknown to exist. And how it could be here and could be interacting with us, of course, is anyone's guess, but there are a lot of potentials that we could look at. But one point I try and drive home with the UFO singularity is, sure, we can acknowledge that we are dealing with something that appears to be a few steps ahead of us, but maybe not centuries and centuries like a lot of the ufologists out there would have us think. For it to be an intelligent species visiting from another planet, ideally they would have to be a few centuries ahead of us in terms of being able to access the kinds of technologies that would allow them to travel through deep space. If more singularitarians would look at this argument, they, on the other hand, might say, contrary to what the ufologists say, thanks to such things as the law of accelerating returns and such concepts that transhumanists might employ, it very well may be that technologies that would allow for that kind of space travel would be accessible much sooner in Earth terms than the several centuries that we think it might take for them to be accessible. So even if we do look at the extraterrestrial component here in terms of what UFOs may be, understanding the link, the potential link between what we call transhumanist futurist technologies and the existent UFO enigma may help us to better understand the ways that the UFO and aspects of the UFO enigma are operating.
So you kind of see technology moving towards a kind of bioorganic assimilation of like human and machine.
No, I definitely think here on Earth technology is going in that direction, but I'll tell you this, too. A lot of people think that once we reach the singularity, we're all going to be a bunch of cyborgs walking around, or we're going to fully supplant our physical bodies with cybernetic ones, which effectively might allow us to live forever. That's not a very comforting thought for a lot of people, but I would argue that the whole point of advancement of technology is to make it less and less invasive over time.
Right.
Two points that I want to make here are this. First and foremost, if a fully functional, highly advanced technology is developed that can literally replace such things as organs or limbs or anything like that, I doubt it's going to be something that will appear very mechanical. If anything, the height of that technology, and again, we're years and years and years away from being able to achieve this, but the height of that level of technology would be something that would literally mimic the organic.
Right.
It would appear to be something organic, which is a little bit more digestible, I think, to a lot of people, even though that gets into the realm of playing with God. But the other thing, too, is that people say that they would outright reject the idea of replacing bodily parts and organs and limbs and things with mechanical parts. But what about your granddad who's got a pacemaker? We're already doing this. And the thing is that when we're looking at future technologies that will implement more and more innovative ways to do this, it's not going to be so much that we're creating some sort of a cyborgic Frankenstein. It's that we're utilizing a more efficient variety and several different varieties of technologies that will improve on things we're already beginning to do right now.
Right. So maybe it's just the idea of it being terrifying because of people with a more excessive personality would kind of visualize it as being this huge transformation to this monstrous cyborg, like non-human being, or just like the assimilation of technology and the human anatomy or the human mind, you know, that type of thing.
Right, yeah, in essence. And that's the whole thing, is that we grapple with the potentials for the technologies of tomorrow because we try and take those radical new concepts and we try and put those into the context of the today that we are used to. And naturally, those things are going to seem at times horrific.
Sure.
Again, and it's so funny because I have so many people that argue with me and really find the whole transhumanist singularity
concept very, very distasteful, of course it's going to seem very distasteful to us today. And frankly, a lot of the people who actually are advocates of singularity, transhumanism, neither of which I'm necessarily an advocate of, I certainly am interested in these things, and I've chosen to write about them, but I'm not some preacher who's out there trying to preach the transhuman gospel. I really, if anything, am more hesitant than I am an advocate for this. But all that to say, when we look at these sorts of things, they're going to seem difficult for people on today's level of thinking, and of course, you know, in society and culture that we know today. And then, by the same token, the people who are advocates of it, they'll look at it and they'll say, now, but what kind of possible connection could you see here between transhumanism, singularity, and UFOs? Many of the people who I interviewed for the UFO singularity would tell me that straight up. As a matter of fact, Ben Gertzel, PhD, who is an expert on artificial intelligence and probably one of the world's best, I asked him what if there were any connection, and if so, what he thought that would be. And he said, I see no connection between singularity or transhumanism and UFOs. And then he said, and this is what's funny, however, I do think that once we get to a singular point in a post-singularity world, we will probably be capable of utilizing technologies that will make the unexplained mysteries of today seem a lot less mysterious. And again, as a central theme to the UFO singularity for me is that these technologies are going to help us kind of level the playing field. And I believe that in a post-singularity world, the UFO enigma will no longer be a mystery, because there will be technologies present here on Earth that, if it's anything other than human, they will certainly allow us to better understand, study, and even perhaps interact with that technology. And by the same token, if it's clandestine technologies that exist here on Earth, singularity-esque technologies will also make it so that these kinds of things that seem so strange and remote for the time being will eventually become the norm. And I think that we may eventually, to put it concisely, get that future with flying cars and all kinds of weird stuff we've all been waiting decades and decades for. It's just going to look a little different than what the guys back in the 1920s and 30s imagined.
Right. Well, I mean, I've always wanted a robot best friend, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may not even have to have a robot for a best friend. I mean, you got Jeffrey already, but the thing is, he's much better than a robot. But the thing is that in a future where, again, artificial intelligence may not have to be housed within a robot body, and by the same token, any kind of cybernetic enhancements or all-out artificial, appendages, bodies, vessels, avatars that we would be capable of creating, they may be so close to organic that, and again, this is troubling for people, but rather than creating robot best friends, we may be creating new kinds of beings.
Like life form.
Yeah, people are often thinking, God, what are you talking about? Right. And that's the thing, is people are also often saying, you guys are talking about creating, a robot race. We see how this turns out, for people in the movies, and it's very seldom to the benefit of humankind. Well, first, I would argue that, again, that's Hollywood for you. And we could really get off on that subject, later and talk about why I don't know that a river occur. But by the same token, I don't know that if we reach that penultimate state of harnessing artificial technologies capable of producing artificial intelligence that could be carried within some sort of an artificial vessel, I don't know that the vessel is going to look like the Terminator or T-1000 or something quite like that. It would probably look a lot more like us once we reach that stage in the development of our own technological systems.
I'm starting to understand it as post-human, kind of like a post-human concept, like just the creation of a new life form. And I think one of the reasons why people would have so much trouble with that is just kind of like the xenophobia aspect that you experience with, racism or anything like that is, what place does this creature have with us now, And I think that that's just been a crippling, kind of debilitating thought process throughout our, in human history.
Well, I agree. And, another thing that's important to look at here along those lines is that, we're so often looking at, something that often happens when we watch films about this sort of a thing, and we see the idea of aliens visiting a planet like Earth, these same sort of questions come up. You know, there was actually, I think, a television program on back in the 90s that was called Alien Nation, I think, and
In essence,
what happens is aliens are here on Earth, and it was the very same sort of thing as District 9. Okay, they're here now. What kind of rights do they have? Where do they live? What do we do for them? We have to coexist. How do we coexist with them? And I think that, again, as a thought experiment, one of the unique things about looking at the UFO enigma from a transhumanist perspective is that it also allows us to see the very same sorts of questions that we've had about exopolitics over the last several decades, i.e., what if UFOs land on the White House lawn? Do we interact with them? Do we become friends with them? If they're friendly or if they're hostile, how do we, in a diplomatic way, try and manage a potential threat here? When we look at the potentials in transhumanism, we're faced with virtually all those same criteria. If we create a new kind of intelligence that is intelligent like humans but not human, then we have, well, they're Earthlings because they were created or quote-unquote born here. We're also looking at a species, that, or if you want to call them a species, a creation of something that is going to have to be, if it's intelligent and conscious, it's entitled to its own set of rights, values, virtues, all these sorts of things, and laws. One of the interesting concepts that came up in a New York Times article that was kind of crowdsourcing people's ideas about the future, and I believe I mentioned this in the UFO Singularity in the first chapter, is that it was an entire listing of ideas, essentially, looking at the next 100 years, or actually the next several hundreds of years, what kinds of things we can expect from the future and from technologies, and the advent, especially, of artificial intelligence. And one of them was that, for the first time, an artificial variety of intelligence is tried for a crime, in jail.
Right.
Or in court. What happens if that being ends up sentenced to jail? So a lot of these sorts of questions about how do humans interact with or coexist alongside non-human entities that we would see from ufology looking at the alien equation, those things are kind of relevant with transhumanism too in a variety of technology that visits us here.
Mm.
It's a variety of intelligence that we create that may present us with new technologies right here in our midst and of our own creation.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe that's what we're going to have to learn, is to accept these, aliens and transhumans as viable life forms, just like us, with the same ideas, But that's a huge topic. I don't know if there's ever going to be a solution for that type of thing, but I'd like to think so.
I'd like to think so also, but again, I think that, where we're woefully deficient is, first of all, when we look at ourselves today, I think that the first big hurdle is even trying to predict what the technologies of tomorrow may potentially bring.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because if we do acknowledge such things as the law of accelerating returns, and what that essentially entails is this, that as our technology grows and expands, there is a sort of a cumulative effect in the sense that we create more and more. And more that we create, the more there is to influence the new innovations of tomorrow. And the more that influences the innovations of tomorrow, the more quickly those innovations are developed and the more quickly they are improved upon and the more quickly they are replicated. And so as you can see, the more technology that we harness, the more intelligence that we wield as a civilization, the more quickly the rate of growth of our technology increases just as well. And so what we are dealing with essentially here is a growth that is greater than hyperbolic, okay? And as our technological innovations continue to increase more and more rapidly, this is what's literally not only going to, first of all, change before we even have time to think about what the future technologies of tomorrow may be, it's right. going to change fundamentally what those technologies are, and then it's also going to probably bring that quote-unquote singular point, that event horizon that we call technological singularity, it's going to bring that to us much more quickly than people think, which is why most people thinking about the standard semi-measurable rate of growth of technology that we know today, the largest general rate of progression, they think about that in terms of being linear. It's a constant, steady growth rate. Sure, if things continued to grow steadily and constant like that, we might not begin to see beginnings of singularity-esque technologies. In other words, artificial intelligence. For another several hundred years. But if you think about this and take into consideration the accurate rate of the growth of effect I'm talking about here, again, we're looking at something that will be here much sooner. And I think it's relevant at this point also to interject that Werner Venge, another of the gentlemen who I asked to interview for this book, he declined very gracefully. But he said to me that... what I had hoped to ask of him during the planned interview was about something he'd said about singularity many years ago. Now, for those who are unfamiliar with him, Werner Venge is a mathematician and a science fiction writer. But he coined the term singularity back in 1983, I believe. And he referred to singularity as, you know, along the same lines of the actual use of the term in relation to the singularity of a black hole. It's beyond that point after which matter and all reality that we know breaks down. We cannot even, the human mind cannot conceptualize that, and that's why he refers to it as singularity, because he says that after this point, where our technology begins to merge with ourselves, and that we are creating intelligences that exceed natural levels of human intelligence, that really fundamentally changes the world as we know it. And some people, I guess the more bleak descriptions of it, have been given as such. They call it the end of human life as we know it. It very well may be that, but not in the sense that we're all going to die. It just may be, like you'd said, a post-human sort of realization or reality kind of takes over. And so Werner Venge, when asked how would we know when singularity arrives, and this is what's so fascinating to me, he said, we will know singularity has arrived when we are confronted by, in our everyday lives, phenomena that we have no explanation for. But again, think about this in terms of UFO phenomenon, much of which is so strange and bizarre. I've spoken with so many researchers, so many individuals, you know, people who are civilians, people who work in government, people who are academics, people who are very intelligent and have, you know, credentials out the wazoo, and then they won't,
sure.
they can't come forward and talk about, you know, this, you know, publicly because of their professions. But and after it's all said and done, the general consensus I get is that while I think there are a lot of secret technologies out there that are man-made, there are some things in our reality that we simply cannot explain, and that's why people often gravitate toward that extraterrestrial theory, because that's really, in terms of Occam's razor, that seems, well, the easiest explanation. If these things aren't ours, then they must be flesh and blood aliens. People give themselves to that with no real proof of it. There's some compelling evidence, but what we cannot deny, guys, is that certainly there is such a phenomenon here in our midst today, and whatever that is, often it is unexplainable. Just like Werner Venge said, we would be able to begin to witness at the advent of what he called technological singularity. So is it already here? Maybe so, in some capacity.
Well, yeah, what I was going to say, let me say this.
Sure.
Drones. I mean, look at drone technology. Sure, most of them, they all are remote controlled, but in a way, that is approaching the technology of UFOs and possibly derived from that sort of technology back in World War II and stuff like that. But also, one thing that kind of bothers me with ufology, and I'm not going to say every ufologist does this, but a lot of them, they don't talk about drones at all. I mean, it's rare. They talk about, you know, some things like that, but not every ufologist out there. There's a more of a less of them who, well, more than less, who don't even bring up the subject at all. And that's what's so confusing and befuddling about UFO sightings these days, is you don't know if it's governmental or extraterrestrial, or, you know, it's a drug. People are so quick to say, oh, it's ET with a glowing finger, oh, yada yada yada, from planet Zanzibar, when it could be just a drone. So I could see this drone technology definitely being, you know, part of what you're talking about too, with the singularity or a phase of it, for sure. So what do you think about drones and all that stuff?
I think you're really close to where my own logic lies there, Jeffrey. And, of course, you and I, we correspond a good bit about this sort of stuff, so I may have even brought that up to you. But, you know, I wrote a pretty lengthy article about drones in relation to UFOs for New Dawn magazine last summer, and I've also written several articles at my website, also at our sister site, Mysterious Universe. I'm not directly affiliated with Mysterious Universe aside from writing for them. I'm good friends with the guys. It's Ben and Aaron from Mysterious Universe that do that. But, yeah, I get a lot of questions because I write for the site, so people are like, are you Mysterious Universe? I'm a good friend, too, but I can't take any credit beyond that is the thing. So, but I've written a lot of articles, though, and at least one or two for Mysterious Universe about this. And, again, I think, you know, every now and then you do see people kind of touching on this. I think the general consensus among the UFO researchers, though, is pretty much, or rather, I shouldn't say consensus, I should say it's an attitude. The general attitude among most UFO researchers seems to really be, to me, that if it is something that is explainable as a government technology, then it's not a UFO. I.e., they expect that a UFO has to, again, be something that is not our own, whereas I would argue that the most are our own. And as I get into in the book, if there's a potential that some UFO technologies could, you know, and I hate to use the term time travel, but it is a conventional modern term that is used to describe the potential that someone from our temporal future or past or whatever else might be literally capable of traveling through dimensional space and time in a way that we at present do not understand to exist or understand to even be possible. I do dislike the term time travel because I would argue quite simply that if space and time are illusions, and I think that they are, there's no need to have to travel through time. Right. And I think that the problem with time and time travel really has more to do with human perception of time rather than the actual literal necessity for some sort of a technology that can travel through it. And so all that to say, I wouldn't doubt the notion that certain UFO technologies, in addition to being something extraterrestrial or whatever, could also be something that just, you know, emanates from what we would call the perceptual future, and because of the nature of the technology underlying how they operate, they're capable of wafting in and out of our perceptual temporal present as well. And we, from time to time, observe these things, and that would probably explain some of the more strange encounters people have with UFOs, i.e. these things splitting into two, disappearing, stopping on a dime, doing very strange things. These strange things that we witness UFOs doing, rather than being actual physical behaviors of some physical controlled craft in our dimensional space, these rather could maybe be something along the lines, in some instances at least, of a variety of different kinds of technologies that appear very, you know, unexplainable, or even at times maybe even absurd in the fashion in which they behave and seem to be controlled. They do very erratic things. I would argue that some of these behaviors could be the byproducts of some sort of a technology emanating from what we might call, for lack of a better term, a different temporal dimension than ours. So, but all that to say, coming back to drones, there are a variety of different potentials in terms of technology that may exist in our midst already, and I wouldn't call a human from the future traveling around in some sort of a advanced craft, I wouldn't call that an alien by any means. And so when it comes to drone technologies and utilizing unmanned aerial craft that don't look like typical airplanes, which can travel at tremendous speed and they're remotely controlled, before long, Jeffrey, I think you'd probably not going to have to be remotely controlled. Some of these drones will probably utilize levels of functional AI for their primary guidance systems and things like this. And so I think, again, much like Singularity, rather than going so far out trying to find our explanations for the UFO enigma, a lot more can be aspect, and how that fits into the equation is the very same sort of thing. Not only do I think a lot of the UFOs witnessed today are probably varieties of drone technologies, but more and more are the varieties of technologies that we utilize for purposes of unmanned aerial vehicles, whether it be for assault or for surveillance or anything else. Those are going to further blur the lines between what we can and cannot easily identify in the skies, and I think that drones are just going to muddy the water in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those damn drones.
Damn them!
I think I've had some come out here to my property. I've had some weird drones. I've had UFO experiences before and seen weird beings from elsewhere, unless it's a drone shooting a hologram into my brain with a EMF frequency, then that's another story. But I have had some drones come out to my property to where me and my brother and nephew were outside, and there was basically what seemed to be a miniature helicopter flying around the trees, and you couldn't see it. Imagine you something swishing around your trees, and you it sounds like a helicopter, but not like a big helicopter, but like a little helicopter, and it's flying around your yard, and you don't see it. It's like it was stealth or something. And I'd never had, you know, it was just the weirdest thing. It was like someone was flying around a remote-controlled helicopters or airplanes around the yard, but you could not see it. So I'm so wouldn't surprise me if they send a couple out here to zap me or something. But those damn drones, they upset me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really a novice compared to you guys when it comes to ufology, and I can never recall a time in my life where I feel like I've had an extraterrestrial or I mean I've seen UFOs or unidentified flying objects, but I'm not sure if they were, you know, flying saucers or, you know, just things that I couldn't identify. And I mean, why I wanted to be on the show tonight was just kind of to see what you had to say about all this, because I mean, I've never done any UFO field work or anything like that, and that's something I've always been curious about, because one of the things you were talking about in the, I think it was the Examiner article, you were talking about how you get out from behind the computer and you go out and do a lot of like field work from time to time, and I mean, that I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, where do you start when you're investigating out in the field for ufology?
Well, if you want to be a UFO field investigator, the first thing I would tell you to do is to go by your local community college or campus bookstore. Actually, better yet, get on Amazon.com, because if you go to a campus bookstore, you're going to spend a lot of money.
Right.
But get on Amazon, get a beginner's guide to the scientific method, which is a short, very practical textbook that is still used in most entry-level science classes that you'll read in a college campus, a lot of college textbooks on hand. I like to keep physics textbooks. I like to keep, and in addition to just textbooks are good. I don't sit around and read them all the time by any means.
Sure.
I reference those, but there are, rather than textbooks, I like reading popular physics books and things like that. And in terms of investigating UFOs, I think that the beginning is, before you step outside your door, try and get a grasp on the scientific method and understand what that is and how it works. And then from that point, can you, and I'm not talking about, you know, memorize the scientific method and write it down on a cue card. I'm talking about
get it tattooed on your hand or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it is good. I mean, if you want to do that, that would be helpful. But what I'm talking about doing is utilize a fundamental understanding of how people, when they study things, utilizing science as a tool, and I'm going to come back to that point in just a moment, understand that process before you go out and observe the world. All of a sudden, you'll find that you have become overnight what I like to call a skeptic, which is what I am. I'm not a person by any means who is going to discount any possibilities or potentials, but again, let's just those first of all, and we'll break it down in what I would like to think is a fundamentally logical, scientific way of exploring this enigma, and very quickly, so that anyone who's listening here could do this and apply this if they go out into the field. And I listen to the skeptics in the background, because I can literally hear them all smirking and laughing and going, "Oh, let's hear what this UFO-ologist has to say about science and UFO hunting." Well, here we go. First of all, when you want to understand the nature of anything around you in the world, and I think all phenomena begins as unexplained phenomena, essentially. One man, mathematician, recently told me, when I asked him if all phenomena didn't begin as unexplained phenomena, he said, "Yeah, certainly to cave salamanders, but I would argue that we're not all born capable of walking outside and knowing exactly what this or that is. We have to be able to apply some sort of logic or knowledge base to those things, and if there's no data set for that that exists, then we have to have a proper methodology of going about studying it and learning.
Sure.
So the first thing primarily to do is to be able to ask questions without giving yourself in to simple notions or ideas. And this is, so we got to stop right there. This is exactly what people have done with ufology for the last several decades. And it was innocent enough, I think, in how that happened. Ufology begins in the modern era, shortly after the Second World War. Actually, we could take it back. I would say that the preface to the novel would be the Foo Fighters.
Okay.
During the Second World War, this was something that was during that shaky, time of conflict. I mean, it was easy enough to assume, as both Allies and Axis powers did, that they were dealing with something that was either the other guys or something else, and we don't know what else it could be, so we're assuming this is some technology that the other guys have got. It comes after the fact that both parties were seeing Foo Fighters. Actually, it came out much later that the Italians were even recording what they called the fascist UFO files that document saucers and things that go all the way back to the 1930s. So what are we left with? We didn't know what these things were, but we acknowledged the UFO problem conclusively after the Second World War, after Project Paperclip, after all these Nazi scientists supposedly are taken where they're supposed to be going, and there are still these strange technologies in our midst that nobody can seem to account for. Now, at that time in our progression, we had not made it into space yet. Humankind had not become a spacefaring civilization. And so when we were looking at these highly advanced technological objects, what appeared to be mechanical and intelligently controlled objects, what we naturally do is they seem to be flying through the sky. When they appear, they often appear in the sky, and when they take off, they disappear off into the sky. Therefore, it seems logical that they may come from the sky. And if they come from the sky, they're not coming out from behind clouds. They're probably descending into Earth's atmosphere. In other words, they may be coming from space. Mm-hmm. What on a planet elsewhere? And we already had in our minds the cultural concept of intelligent alien life visiting Earth and even invading planet Earth. I mean, I'm dating back to the magazines. I think this concept goes back even further than the turn of the last century. I mean, this was something that was well established in our science fiction. So it leaped for scientists to start thinking and postulating and speculating and saying, okay, could we be dealing with extraterrestrials? Now, what does this have to do with someone who wants to get out and study UFOs scientifically? Well, I think it's a lesson to be learned, because what we see happen there was this. The scientific establishment at that time took UFOs very seriously. Again, a breath after the Second World War. They took it seriously because these objects appeared to be something that could be a great risk for national security. We didn't know who they were, what they were, or what they were capable of doing, and so they were a great security risk. Our intelligence agencies took this problem very seriously, but they jumped to conclusions, and those memes that were planted carefully back then have remained to this very day, and those memes are that we're dealing with something that must be, because it couldn't be anything else, extraterrestrial in nature. The first step to understanding UFO is not to jump to a conclusion when you don't have any proof. There is plenty of evidence that could substantiate an extraterrestrial hypothesis, but none that proved modest. People who have really tried to evaluate the UFO enigma, they would agree. So when you're trying to understand things scientifically, understand and differentiate carefully between evidence and proof. This is the most unscientific fields, because for years, for decades, people have done nothing but take evidence, and they have tried to tout that as being proof of extraterrestrial visitation. If somebody could show me proof of extraterrestrial visitation, I'd probably have to buy them a hot dog, and I guarantee I'm not going to get any lunch anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do a lot of paranormal investigation, research, experimentation. That's kind of always been where I've been, in the kind of the paranormal school. And I think what you just told me about the obvious thing of the UFO phenomenon creating a national security threat is always what's kind of it separates, I think, the ufologist from the paranormalist, like the paranormal investigator. because it seems so much more real, you know. And it's because I see a lot of paranormalists and ufologists splitting hairs all the time, you know. And I'm not really in that kind of a school of thought. I'm just in it all the way, you know, with everything, you know. Like, I'm just trying to understand as much as I possibly can, make something of it. So I understand the differences, and but do you think that's what it is then? Is in the paranormal field, you can apply scientific methods, but there's nothing to really quantify any of that, you know?
Well, that is a problem. You know, I think a better way to apply it, see, because here's the other problem with UFOs. If you're going to go out into the field and try and study UFOs, the first problem is, okay, well, observation. Okay,
right.
Let's go out and let's begin by observing UFOs. Now, there are a few instances where, or locations where people claim that they have been able to successfully, repeatedly observe UFOs. And let's say that you found a location like that, you could form a hypothesis, which might be, for instance, okay, I think that these UFOs, like Philip Klass said back in the 1970s about the illuminations that appeared over Brown Mountain, New York, or North Carolina, mm-hmm. I think that these are lights from off in the distance. Now, let's see if we can find a way to prove this. Now, what Klass claimed that he did was that he utilized data. Okay, I think he had actually gone by the U.S. Geological Survey data mm-hmm. in determining the direction of the approaching lights of distant locomotives. And he was able to determine that in many instances, reports of lights allegedly seen around the vicinity of the Linville Gorge and Brown Mountain in North Carolina were indeed the oncoming lights of locomotives. Now, here's where his logic, and this is what you have to be careful of, that sounds like to a lot of people, good science. It was not good science. Here's where Philip J. Klass, you got to keep in mind, I mean, this guy, he was not only a popular journalist and also an aviation expert, but frankly, all around, someone who should have known better. Here's where Klass went wrong. The data that he utilized, the Geological Survey and other sources, most of it dated back. This book was, I think his book was called UFOs Identified, or UFOs Explained, I guess, was the title. But anyway, the book was written in 1974, I think, is when it went out, in print. And he was referencing information for that particular chapter on Brown Mountain. That information dated all the way back to, I believe, the 1920s.
Okay.
And it's like, dude, if you can't do any better than to reach back, I mean, literally half a century, get your data set to substantiate your weak argument. And then second of all, here's his other problem. Despite the fact that there's a rich literature that associates the Brown Mountain lights with being a variety of aerial phenomenon, he states this in the book, notes that the observation point is a higher elevation than the lights that were being witnessed in the distance. In other words, the lights were clearly set against the backdrop of the ground level.
Right.
Put themselves at an extremely high elevation for each of these experiments. Which were referenced in Klass's estimation. So, yes, he claimed to have effectively debunked some variety of unexplained aerial phenomena, but from the elevation that this observation was done, there was no way to tell clearly if the objects emanated from the ground or if they were indeed above the tree line. So the thing is that you can't utilize bad data and substantiate a perception, and this is something I see skeptics doing time and time again. They go into something, they go into their quote-unquote scientific evaluation with a preconception, and then they try and substantiate their argument. They will woefully discount any better data that may actually detract from their pet theory. Now, not all skeptics do this. I'm not
sure.
I
understand.
In Cass's case, he certainly did. He woefully ignored half a century of data that might have had to do with the Brown Mountain light phenomenon and basically used outdated data that clearly couldn't have determined if there was anything seen in the sky at all, and he used that to prop up a pet theory. So what I would argue is, again, you know, when it comes to studying UFOs, Brown Mountain is one of those few locations where there is a debatable phenomenon, and we still see that people basically, when they've tried to explain that, it was a complete hack job. But that would be a good place to start, is because it's a location like the Marfa Lights or like Hestel in Norway, where there seems to be a repeatable phenomenon. But the problem is, too, is that, you know, even though we cannot conclusively prove this, strong evidence suggests that the light formations that show up at Hessel and Norway, Brown Mountain, and other locations like that are probably a variety of plasma. So I'd say first, okay, we can study plasmas and earth lights, and we can learn the behavior and what causes these lights to form. And if we can understand that, that is one variety of unexplained...
Hey, Larry, we got to take a break. So if you could, we'll make that a stopping point. Joe's, I got to take a break. He's making me. He'll spank
That's fine.
Me.
We'll pick up there.
So we're gonna take an 8 to 10 minute break. You're listening to UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we'll be back with Micah Hanks, and
awesome.
We'll get into this the Locust Grove sighting, and then we'll also delve into UFOs a little bit more, and then I want to talk about the Reynolds Mansion. So we'll be back shortly. So they'll take a leak or something, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from Tuesdays.
Breaking news! Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them! Don't put that probe there! Don't put that probe there! Don't put a...
Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabusradio.com.
You've been listening to News on the Flip Side with Joe Montaldo and Stephanie Benetti. Join us each Saturday, 8 p.m. Central, to hear the latest news on current events. Expect the unexpected as our hosts offer their opinion on some of the most controversial topics of the day. News on the Flip Side, only on UPRN 107.9 New Orleans.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway. MindCemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, East Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
You are listening to UPRN 107.9, New Orleans.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, the world needs to hear the truth.
Welcome back to the Church of Mavis Radio Show, everybody, and commercial break. Just to let my audience members know, the reason I'm a little quiet tonight is I'm going through another breakup with a Mexican. It's my first time dating out of my white race, which I'm really French, Irish, and Cherokee, and alien, so that's my first time really being with a different type of race, and first it was okay, but she starts talking a lot, you know, she just talks nonstop, and after a while, all that talking just starts to make you crazy, so a lot of fighting, and then winter hit, suddenly she don't shave her armpits, so things got really bad from that start. I like when women shave their armpits, so like I was talking about with Micah and Beelzebub on break, it's like I have a girl with Ewoks under her arm, so it's like dating the abominable snowman, for Christ's sake. So going through some pressure on the home front that'll hopefully be cleared up in a month or so. But it's been pretty bad, a lot of fighting and stuff like that, so I'm tired, wore out. I'm just going to do the single thing for a while and write my book finally and stay away from women. If you know what I mean. If you know what old Jack means, just private on the cusp. People ask me why I'm so personal on the radio talking about my life all the time. But it's because I want to touch with the audience. Right. I know there's another guy out there who's gone through this, you know, a girl with friggin', you know, Ewoks under her arm. So I want to touch their heart. That's why I'm personal about my private affairs. I want to touch the face and the heart of humanity and talk about this stuff. You know, you get a Mexican girlfriend with Yetis under her arm. You know, it's this
disappointing. It hurts you on the inside. Yeah. Right now, I'm just trying to get through the night and hope I don't get my penis cut off, you know, and thrown in an ant pile like Lorena Bobbitt or scared. Hold me.
Yeah, it's like,
anyway,
you're kissing my soul right now.
I'm tonguing your soul. But no, I honestly, my luck with women, I swear to God, I think in a past life I was Jack the Ripper or something, and I'm getting karmic crap back for something bad. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, man, I'm a crazy magnet. I'm a magnet for crazy chicks. But another contactee, too. Oh, my God. Stay away from those. Oh, Jesus. And it's funny. When I always date these contactee women, nothing ever happens. It's like I've had stuff happen to me, so I go, they're contactees, too, or so they say. So I figure, you know, more stuff will happen when we live together, and it never does. So I'm like, what the hell, man? Aliens? What's up with that? So right. Either they're full of it or I don't know, but that's... It's a whole other show. But anyway, let's get back to UFO singularity. Mike, are you there? Or did you hang up?
I almost hung up, but I'm here.
So let's talk about that. My experiences happened in Georgia, and there were some UFO experiences with multiple witnesses, and friends thought I was attracting them to myself. And family mom, who about ripped my arm off, she was so scared. She saw some black craft coming out of some kind of energy vortex in the sky. And just a lot of weird stuff happened in Georgia. I even saw some odd-looking, peculiar beings that were multidimensional on some level. But there's a Locust Grove sighting, right? Now, I'd like to talk about that and then get into the Reynolds Mansion.
Well, you're right. I'm still reeling, to be honest, with you from beholding and hearing of your relationship woes, Jeffrey. I almost feel like the remainder of this hour I should spend providing a consultation to you or something. You know, Jeffrey, tell me about your mother. But you actually just did tell me about your mother, actually. But that said, you know, Locust Grove is an interesting story. It's a chapter in my book. I mean, I'm not so lame as to just call the chapter Locust Grove, you know. But there's a chapter in my book that deals with that. In essence, what the Locust Grove story was it had to do with a gentleman who I've come to know pretty well since. Actually, I mean, I'd gotten to know him fairly well prior to writing the UFO Singularity, because one of the field cases that I'd begun studying when I began research for the book was this story. The gentleman first contacted me because I was he was a listener of my podcast, The Graylian Report, and he contacted me. And he said, I have a very interesting story, and I really haven't shared it with anyone in several decades. And, you know, I'll let you have it if you want it. You know, I can email it to you, and you can read read the story on your show or whatever you want to do. So the story went that 1973, it was a pretty chilly November evening. He'd recalled that there was a bit of a mist rising off of the ground. And on this particular occasion, he was coming back from a little town, probably, I think it was Marietta, south of Atlanta. And as he's driving along, Mike Reese is the gentleman, and he had his wife at the time, his sister's two little infant daughters, and I think his first child. And they're driving along, and Mike notices a strange white light off in the distance coming out over the North Georgia Highlands. And as he's looking at this thing, as Mike's watching this object, he says that, you know, although it looks in the sky at first, he says that it for some reason looks very different from a helicopter or an airplane. And so he continues watching this object and
trying to figure out what this thing is that he's seeing. And before long, he's coming up on the turnoff, the Bill Gardner Highway, which would take him back over to, I think it's Interstate 75, that would take him north the rest of the way to Atlanta. Well, Mike misses his turnoff intentionally, drives right by it. And at that point, his wife kind of says, "What are you doing? Where are you going?" And he says, "I've got to get a better look at this thing." And he keeps going. He keeps heading, I guess, north along this little side road. And at this point, he's able to see a bright light shining through the trees. And Mike said, "You know, I always read Fate magazine. My dad had been a subscriber, and I would always stay subscribed to tuned in to the latest on these sorts of subjects and things like that." And so apparently, as the story goes, he's seeing this light coming up through the trees and everything, and as he gets up on this object, he's about to round this corner where these pine trees, this kind of grove of pine trees ends, and he's going to be able to see this light. And as he comes around the corner, there's a power substation there on the left side of the road. And hovering above the power substation, of course, is this huge object. I think he said that this thing, he was like a Polara with a push button transmission, and so this thing probably, I think, from where he was several hundred feet wide. It was a large saucer shaped craft, had red, green, and blue lights around the exterior. He said that in the dark light it was difficult to see, but there was some illumination coming from the power substation it was hovering over, and so that he had thought that if anything, this thing must have been a kind of a dark gunmetal gray. And so most people who would see this, they would maybe observe it driving by, and they wouldn't necessarily want to, you know, hang around. Mike pulls over off the side of the road, gets out of the car, and starts waving his arms at this thing. And he told me, he said, "You know, the only thing I could ever think was, I just wanted to know what was in that thing. I wanted to know who was in it," is what Mike said. And so, you know, he's waving his arms. Meanwhile, his wife and his sister are just over there in the car, and they're freaking out. And it was a very, very troubling experience for all of them, because he said that after this craft hovered a few more minutes over the substation, that it eventually began to drift away. And he said that it would have gone directly over the interstate. He knows somebody else had to have seen this thing that night. Having never had that experience, would have been like coming north across through Locust Grove and headed north to Atlanta that evening and seeing this thing hovering over the interstate. So it was just an incredible encounter. And, you know, Mike said, I went back to the car and I tried to get my wife and my sister calmed down, but they were both very, you know, shaken. They were very rattled, and so he said it took him forever to get them to calm down, but he did. He got them to calm down, and once they finally kind of relaxed, they hardly had any words to say to one another on their way home. And he finally got home, and then the next day he felt sick while he was at work, and he had worked for the Division of Transportation, and he said he'd been driving down the road, and he had to pull off to the side of the road and vomit. He said, I felt so sick. And after he went to the infirmary, they told him, well, you suffered from an optical headache. God knows what an optical headache is. Yeah. And so I decided I'd tell one of my coworkers, a guy who worked in my department, about what I'd seen. And so he did. Mike decided to start talking to this coworker, this gentleman. And he says, the gentleman and I had always talked about astronomy, and both of us growing up, we were fascinated with astronomy, you know, and stargazing and things like this. This guy, he said, took his glasses off and sat there and looked at Mike like he was a idiot. And he said, at that moment, he said, this is someone I felt like, if anybody I could probably tell this to, I thought this guy would be accepting of what I was talking about here. Mm-hmm. That was not the case. And so it was very sad, because he said, altogether, I had to give up what I'd been so excited about the night before. I thought I'd had the experience of a lifetime. And he said nobody would even believe it. And so for four decades, Mike Reese kept the story of the incident at Locust Grove to himself. He didn't tell anybody about it until he began listening to the Graylian Report podcast. And then he decided to call me. And
and tell me that story. He emailed me first, but eventually we set up time to speak via Skype, and then I went and joined he and his wife and his sister for dinner, and I was able to speak with some of the witnesses who had actually been there and seen this thing. And then Mike and I eventually traveled together down to Atlanta and went all the way down to Locust Grove and turned to the power substation. So if you read the book, The UFO Singularity, and I get into the theory and more about Mike's background into that chapter and what we think that thing was and what was going on, but if you get the book and you read in that chapter, there are some interesting photographs, and one of them, of course, is Mike standing there in front of the power substation at Locust Grove, where we went back to. It was his first time going back there since he'd had that encounter in 1973, and I have to say it was almost surreal being there with him that day and seeing where this thing had appeared. A lot of people, actually, the majority of people who read the book find that pretty interesting. They enjoy the story. They thought it was interesting, my line of thought applied to the saucer itself and what may have been going on there. But I have had a few people say that they felt that I spent way too much time talking about that case and that it really didn't help us understand anything much about ufology to delve into that case. But I think that, again, my argument to that fundamental problem with ufology today, people are so willing to listen to stories because they're good stories, and when it comes to UFO research, they don't seem to really know what to do or be willing to do anything with the story. And so in that instance, when it comes down to talking about, and this, you know, gets into what we were talking about last hour, field research, you know, I gathered every bit of information about the character of the individual, the location. We traveled there. I took photographs, measurements, all that kind of stuff. Four decades after the fact, I'm not going to find evidence of a UFO that appeared in 1973. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it was good to document all that sort of stuff. And then to look at this and try and say, okay, what were we dealing with? And I thought that was very interesting about this was the fact that at the beginning of the encounter, Mike had said that he'd seen a white light. But when he got up to the power substation, he said that he saw red, green, and blue lights. Mm-hmm. Well, red, green, and blue lights, according to the additive theory of color theory of light, mm-hmm. when you combine red, green, and blue lights, you get white light, which is kind of interesting. Contrary to, you know, red, yellow, and blue primary colors, and they'll give you kind of a muddy brown when you combine all those. So I thought it was interesting because Mike said that these lights, when the craft was hovering over the power substation, he said he could see them moving in sequence, red, green, blue, and he said that literally, although he wasn't sure if this is how it was, he said that the lights flashed like embers of a fire, and that it almost gave the impression that there was a single light source on the interior that was moving in circles, and that as it moved around, these colored portholes around the exterior were lit up by a object or a bright light from the interior or something along those lines. Altogether, the important point here is that it gave Mike the impression that the centrifuge, if you will, remained static while the exterior of the saucer, the disc portion of the craft, actually spun in a circle and moved around this thing. And what's very interesting is that if you get into some of the, actually, as a matter of fact, there have been some rather controversial recent studies, in addition to some going all the way back to Arago's principle, which is that a spinning metallic disc, or rather some of the research that had been applied from that had been that a spinning metallic disc will have interesting effects on such things as gravity, as well as the apparent magnetic pull of the Earth. For instance,
sure.
If one takes a spinning metallic disc and orients that beneath a compass needle, all of a sudden the effect of magnetic north is somewhat lessened on that compass needle. And if this sort of relationship between a spinning metallic disc and magnetism were affected, I began to wonder what would be the effect between a spinning metallic disc and gravity, which gets us into the question of what is the difference between gravity and magnetism. And the funny thing is that what we fundamentally get down to is the notion that, you know, we have strong, weak electric forces, you know, or electromagnetism, essentially electricity and magnetism, and then we have gravity. All these sorts of forces in our universe, according to general theory, would stem from one other varieties of energies, but all of them are essentially manifestations of the same thing. emanating from the Big Bang, one fundamental energetic, whatever that would be, at the beginning of all. Yeah. And so it's very interesting because we obviously are dealing with a technology that we can kind of see the beginnings of understanding it, and yet by the same token, and I think, frankly, I'm certainly not a person who's trained in being able to understand the engineering of a flying saucer, but just my own peripheral, you know, study and an examination of that, it was fairly easy for me to begin to find parallels between spinning metallic discs and essentially what we would call gravity reversal or something along those lines. And so that is indeed the case. It seems to me that what the craft was that Mike saw in 1973, to my mind, was probably more of a, probably more likely to be an earthbound technology. Not that it couldn't have been from elsewhere, but again, you know, I don't think that it would be impossible for a technology like that to be harnessed here on planet Earth. Mm. It certainly wasn't one of the more far-out UFO reports that I've ever heard.
Right. I mean, I think it's important to not be an armchair theorist.
Right.
You know, I know I've read a lot of books probably and been, totally impressed by and a lot of books that have been written are good that have been all based on research. But I mean, I think it's better to go out in the field and check it out, do interviews, go meet the people, collect the data, and then put it all together in something that's a lot comprehensive.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what the funny thing is, though, is that nonetheless, people would, I'm sure still, a lot of them call me an armchair researcher. Because, you know, rather than going and spending my time in a lab or, you know, having a degree in this sort of stuff, I'm a journalist. I'm not a scientist, you know. That's the thing, and that's why I don't spend more time in the laboratory. And what's funny is, if anyone wants to criticize the, and not that you are doing it or that I am, because I agree 100%, sure. I think it's good to just be an armchair researcher, but if anyone wants to criticize researchers who are only able to do with what they have in terms of trying to understand UFOs or anything else,
sure.
I recommend that those individuals read Jacques Vallée's book Confrontations,
okay.
A Science Search for Extraterrestrial Life, because in that book he talks about the costs incurred and also the trouble with having to go to trying to have a sample of metal alleged to have been retrieved from some sort of a unidentified flying object.
Right.
Long story short, and he puts this out very concisely for us, Jacques Vallée points out that the reason that chemical analysis and sampling and things like this and scientific evaluation is less often carried out than many would like is because it's often very costly, and then there's also the trouble of finding a lab that would be willing to do the test and a technician that would be willing to put their name behind a, you know, for in this
right.
instance, essentially it would be a scientific study pertaining to something that they could, lose their jobs over.
Right.
Got to keep in mind, like with this Sasquatch DNA study, there's all, you see all this mess that's broken out about this. That's literally.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty much for the last year been heavily in the Sasquatch community, and I'm getting reposted a lot of places. My interviews with different people from David Paulides to Christopher Noel, getting reposted at Cryptomundo and Bigfoot Evidence. The Bigfoot community, they're crazy. They're crazier than the UFO people. They're like nuts. There's like this one group that wants to get Bigfoot and cut its head off and parading around like King Kong with a semi-assault rifle. Then there's the researchers. Then there's the weird telepaths.
No, I would argue if you want to really understand Bigfoot, there are a few people who are really doing a good job and who are really studying this, you know. And frankly, what I think is from a very academic perspective, you know, I would tell people to read Lauren Coleman's writing. I've known Lauren for years, and I think that really nobody does a better job in a journalistic sense working on and writing on and categorizing and compiling data on the Sasquatch Enigma than Lauren Coleman does. And then Jeffrey Meldrum, and again, he's another fine example of even a better example than Melba Ketchum, because the point I was going to make with Melba Ketchum with regard to the Sasquatch DNA thing is that Melba Ketchum has come forward and tried to supply a scientific paper, which I don't think that they've necessarily sequenced Sasquatch DNA. Then with that is that she can't get the paper peer-reviewed, and it's not because nobody wants to deal with the subject. It has to do with the problems with the way that the study has been presented.
Mm-hmm.
Melba Ketchum also owns her own company, DNA Diagnostics, down there in East Texas, and so whether you love her or hate her, I have no opinion on Melba Ketchum. What I'm saying is that she has put her name on the line because she is an entrepreneur, essentially. She has her own business.
Sure.
She's not someone who's working for an academic institution. She's not a tenured professor someplace. If you were that, to get away with
David things. Lacy's is her boss. I mean, that's, I don't know, he's like her boss or something.
Who is?
David Politis.
He is Melba Ketchum's boss.
Yeah, they're part of that Northeast Sasquatch something or another. I interviewed him, and he, that's what he told me. He told me about the whole human DNA thing, like in an interview months before the story even broke on my Examiner, and he said that he was like the boss of it, but for some reason, I guess she's in the limelight. I don't know, it's weird. I haven't really looked in Lauren Coleman's stuff. I got a lot of friends that have disagreements with him, and if half of that stuff's true, then it's scary. But then Lauren Coleman has that weird side about it's like serial killer porn that scares me. So, I don't know what that site is, copycat something, but it's real creepy. But David Politis has some great books, Tribal Bigfoot, The Hoopa Project, and he's a cop, and another dude forensically sketched Bigfoot sightings. Like, every sighting they went to, he sketched what Bigfoot looked like from a forensic police point of view. So the whole book's filled with his pictures. It's just pretty cool. But of course, David did those Missing 411 books. If you ever mention Bigfoot with those, watch out, because he'll bite your face off. But that's another story.
Yeah. I don't mean to be the questioner while I'm being interviewed, but so I take it David doesn't like to have the association drawn between the 411 books and Bigfoot, then?
No, he doesn't.
We'll see.
I think he doesn't. I don't know. It's weird, but he definitely doesn't like to be asked about Bigfoot and Missing 411. I think he doesn't want everyone to think it's Bigfoot doing it, but it could be. Kawani told me that it could be some rogue Bigfoots, like some that have separated from the tribe and are mean or something, and they just do it because they're pissed at everything or whatever, like rogue Bigfoots.
Anarchists.
Take people. I've heard dog people. I've heard Bigfoot. I've heard aliens. I've heard Alan Greenfield, yeah. Transdimensional portals people fall through. I've heard so many different things about Missing 411, but those books are great. Those people really are missing. It's just David definitely doesn't want to talk about what's doing it, which I would love just to pull him aside and make him tell me one day, but he'd probably kick my ass.
David sounds pretty hardcore, but sounds like an interesting guy, and I have to say I've been literally enthralled with the Missing 411 books for some time, and
Go ahead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead. After you.
I have a theory about Bigfoot.
Okay.
A new theory. I don't know if it's ever been heard before. Imagine this. I'm not saying every Bigfoot sighting is this, but imagine that maybe some of them are. You know how people see it? This will lead up to the Reynolds Mansion. You know how people will see a ghost and it'll be dressed like a Civil War soldier or something weird, or a pioneer or some crazy crap or whatever?
Actually, yes.
Like well, imagine this. You're walking through the woods. You know, you're doing your business or whatever. You're a redneck, you're hunting, whatever. And you see, like, a caveman. And, of course, that's like a Bigfoot, pretty much, sort of. And who's to say that you're not in your now moment, and that it's a flux in the matrix, and you like are seeing the past, like a digital movie replaying, and you see that caveman, and it's a Bigfoot to you because you're not going to say, "Oh, I saw a caveman." So it's,
right.
Maybe that's the first thing you would relate it to, or maybe it's kind of like a flux in the matrix, like you would see a Civil War soldier, but you're seeing caveman, but you think it's a Bigfoot when it's really just like you're looking into the past, and it's like the Civil War soldier. Not saying every Bigfoot sighting is like that, because obviously they're not. They're stuff like that, but some of them could be.
It's kind of like
some of these a caveman.
It's kind of like a residual Neanderthal haunting.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty interesting. I never really thought about it, about a Bigfoot sighting being a residual Neanderthal haunting. That's pretty
unique. Some of them, I definitely. I mean, there's a lot of them knocking on trees and
I mean, why not, man? I mean, that's not a bad thought at all.
I've kind of thought about that with the Loch Ness Monster, too, what people are seeing, like, in the past and seeing dinosaurs, and this like weird thing where people see, like, pterodactyls and crap, and like, in their now moment. What if they're just, like, seeing the past? I mean, the same thing with a UFO. What if you're seeing a vehicle, aircraft from the Earth, from humans in the future, but for some reason in the sky there's a flux in the matrix and you're seeing it, you know, like a Civil War soldier, except it's in the future.
Right.
Well, I think you're pretty close to, I would think that was pretty close to right in certain ways. You know, if we want to try and understand things on those terms, you're right, that's a good place to get into the Reynolds Mansion book that I've written. And this is, people who hear interviews with me aren't going to hear a whole lot about this book. I'm promoting the UFO singularity right now, and of course, you know, I've been on the show to talk about magic, mysticism, and the molecule, but there is another mysterious and less often spoken of book that I wrote called Reynolds Mansion, a Invitation to the Past, and it is a book about ghosts and hauntings. Now, it's a fun book. It's a fun book. The book deals with my own experiences researching ghosts and hauntings at a, even though I'm a skeptic, and I do get into some fairly skeptical discourse in the book. At the end, we decided to do a full-on seance. I would argue it was a much more controlled variety of seance than most people are used to. And as I make it clear in the book, there have been a few people who've said, "Man, you don't want to get into that, man. That's some evil. That's some evil stuff. You know, don't do that." Well, in truth, the purpose for doing the seance in the book had been, initially, I thought that the owner of Reynolds Mansion, Billy Sanders, a good friend of mine, was going to be participating. And Dr. Andrew Nicholson, the parapsychologist, has found that in many instances he's been effectively capable of what he calls de-haunting a house. And the way that he manages to do this is that he does what he calls a psychic session, which is essentially, it plays out just like an old-fashioned seance, but what it does is it essentially reestablishes in the mind there being a haunting. Mm-hmm. He essentially allows, through this psychic session, the proceedings of the psychic session, for the people who are the experiencers in the environment to reclaim some level of control over the environment. And I don't think that, and I don't think Dr. Nichols would tell you that it's literally people reclaiming their homes from a spirit. I think it's something that's very psychological. It's, in other words, it points to the psychological nature of the interrelationship between the haunted and then what is perceived as being the haunter. It's very interesting because at Reynolds Mansion, Billy and the people who own the mansion never see the ghosts. It's always the guests that come and tell their strange stories. Now, Billy, in one instance, said that he had seen what looked like a man wearing a sort of a tan or a tweed waistcoat, and this man had appeared and very, very briefly. I mean, Billy, literally, it's out of the corner of his eye, thought there was a man standing there, looked up, and there was no one. That was the only time that he ever saw anything. And he said he literally backed off and, you know, was startled and said, I was standing there alone, he said, and I literally said out loud, "I think I just saw a ghost." But the interesting thing about, and of course, Reynolds Mansion, I love it there, because the interesting thing about the place is that it's this old location. People claim that there are ghosts. It's a very comfortable house, 19-bedroom, 3-story, antebellum brick, double pulpit, it's actually called.
Nice.
And in that book, very much like I researched Mike Reese's UFO encounter and dug up every detail I could, with the Reynolds Mansion book, rather than just telling a bunch of ghost stories, sure, there are plenty of ghost stories that I tell in the book, but I go all the way back to the 1600s. I start there with the Reynolds family in Chichester, England, and I trace the lineage of that portion of the Reynolds family all the way up to the present day.
We look at the previous owner, the woman, Helen, oh gosh, now of course that's what happens is when I'm on live radio talking about this, I forget her last name, but the previous owner of the house who'd sold the place to Billy. And then we also talked to people who had stayed there, we talked to family members, we talked to all the people who are currently working there, we look at all of this. I dig up all the records and the history. I literally went to the National Register of Historic Places information that was kept by the Department of the Interior. There were a lot of documents that were actually kept on the actual site there by the former residents who had left these documents with Billy. And I go through all of this information, and I talk with people who had lived here in town. I dug up old articles from the Asheville Citizen Times and got permission to reprint these articles. And so what it really is a book about the history of this house, but throughout the literal study of the history of the house, there are a lot of ghost stories. And so at the very end of the thing, after really dishing on the history, I even in the book get into the history of the present owners, because I've begun to wonder if there were aspects about the you know, life experiences of and even the psychology of the individuals who live there now and how that might influence the perception.
Right.
I threw out all of this. And then in the final couple of chapters, I kind of wrap up and say, okay, here's what we know about the house. We've gone through this entire history. Now, here are all the really juicy ghost stories. Here's all the stuff that's happened to people who've been here, who've stayed here. Here are the things they've seen. And then finally, let's do a seance, what I call a psychic session. But some of the people who were participants were not aware of the fact necessarily that I was doing this as a psychological experiment. You know, some who were participants, and that was the purpose of the experiment, is that, you know, they were all told after the fact, but the idea was to see what the experience, what about a psychic session might reveal about the experience. And at the end, it's very interesting. I won't tell exactly what happened. Some people read the book and they say, really? There wasn't any kind of a ghost that manifested there in front of you? But what happened in my mind was a lot more interesting as a result of that psychic session, because I will say that I feel that in a very strange, synchronistic, and cosmic way, there was a lot of information imparted, both about the house and about the nature of the haunting. And I can't say that there won't be updates and additions for that book over the years, because you know Reynolds Mansion is just a singular location. It's one of the most interesting haunted locations that you'll ever visit, ever. Mm. It's just one of the most beautiful southern homes that you'll ever visit. And, yeah, it's purported to be haunted. And so it's like having this laboratory that you can go into any time and study based on what people claim that they've had happen. And usually they've usually got good wine and brandy on tap there as well. So
like that.
Yeah, so I'll have a nice glass of Merlot and I'll wander around. And I've spent many a night where I didn't sleep. I just wandered around the entire place. And I know if I ever do see a ghost, that's where I hope it'll be.
Mm. This is in North Carolina or South Carolina? Which one?
It's right here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live. And, a friend of mine, Joshua P. Warren, who lives here in Asheville also, filmed a brief documentary there, which there was a direct-to-DVD release of a film called The Apparition. I hear that the film didn't get necessarily great reviews, but I think, if I remember correctly, I believe that on that DVD, there's an extra features DVD that, at least for a time, was included. It may still be, and it has to do with ghost hunting. It was a real ghost hunting DVD, yeah. Supplemental thing. And Josh,
I've heard of that in that movie, and I almost got it, but I read the reviews and didn't. Maybe I'll check it out anyway.
I've seen the apparition that's based off of the idea of thought form. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
okay.
It is. And the reason I bring that up is because that little vignette there that's on the extra features DVD with Joshua and his friends doing a ghost hunt, which, you know, with all due respect to Joshua, he and I just differ entirely on our approach to the study of psychic phenomena. I don't think, in my opinion, that the ghost hunt and using all the tools and the plants there, as Joshua and others employ. I used to work with Joshua, and this is why I have this opinion. It's not criticizing him or anybody else. It's just saying that I have not found in my experience that the employing of that variety of of equipment and methodology actually helps prove anything about the nature of a haunting, because there are a lot of logical flaws that precede the utilization of those kinds of tools. For instance, we presume that a soul exists, and that a soul existing apart from the body is some sort of an energetic manifestation, is going to represent a ghost in a haunted environment. We know that a electromagnetic field detector that is calibrated for detecting electrical current from a wall is often used in ghost hunting. What about a disembodied spirit apart from a physical body is going to manifest and interestingly, in accordance with a device that is calibrated for detecting, electromagnetic leakage from a microwave oven. Mm-hmm. By the same token, you know, people say, well, let's use the Trifield Natural EM meter. This is a device that can detect the biofield of a human body, and so we put it in an environment by itself, and if an energy like a spirit comes up and interacts with it, we've got a ghost, because it's on a setting where a human, if it were nearby, would interact with it. Well, here's the thing about this, and of course, when I say interact, there's an audible sensor that detects a measurable increase in electric field relative to the position, biofield to the device. Well, sure, it will react that way when it's in close proximity to a body, a living body, but what in the absence of a body, which is why they call it a biofield, what in the absence of the body is going to produce that kind of a field? Now, have I witnessed those meters actually measure what appear to be non-physical, or at very least there's no sort of a physical anything attached to them, what we might call transient electromagnetic fields from time to time that cause those meters to register and react? Yes. But could I tell you that that's a spirit of a dead person? No. Could I tell you what a spirit of a dead person is? No. Can I tell you that the soul even exists? No. So how can we support the notion that a ghost is the spirit of a dead person when that is a faith-based argument? I'm not an atheist, but I'm going to tell you as a scientist that as a faith-based argument, I cannot substantiate those claims based on the notion that a soul of a deceased person is moving around a house, and furthermore, that somehow miraculously, in the absence of a biofield produced by a body, that my electromagnetic field detector is going to pick that up. So I think a lot of the ghost hunting stuff is really useless, and it is truly pseudoscience in the truest way, shape, and form of calling something pseudoscience. But I bring this all up, not to detract from people like Joshua, because Joshua is a good friend. But
we don't have to agree with you on a lot of what you're saying, but I'll let you carry on with your point, though.
Well, all I'd wanted, and thank you for that. But but I also would say that Joshua has contributed a lot to the field, also, especially when coming back to the Brown Mountain that we discussed about earlier. Probably no one's done more actual research in the field at Brown Mountain than Joshua P. Warren. And so, again, you can look at ghost hunting and all this however you want to. Philosophically, my feeling is that there's little that can be gleaned from the study of a ghostly manifestation or purported hauntings from, employing those kinds of sciences and those kinds of, technologies, if you will. And so at Reynolds Mansion, they didn't do a lot of that. But if you watch that extra features DVD that features Joshua and his lemur team, they are actually conducting an investigation at Reynolds Mansion, and so I think it would be worth watching to be able to see Reynolds Mansion. It's very good. And, as far as Joshua's research, I would also recommend brownmountainlights.com so that you can see some of the field work that he's done, really, which so often goes overlooked, and it's really such a shame because it's some of the very best out there with regard to unexplained aerial phenomenon.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot about him, and I've heard about the Brown Mountain Lights and all that, but I'll definitely look into it further.
Brown Mountain stuff is absolutely fascinating, but again, I have, and it's not a difference I have necessarily with Joshua. What it is I have a fundamental difference from the mainstream of ghost people generally, and the reason why is because the pop hauntings and ghost hunting is just that. It's a popular approach. It's not
you
real.
You just get cowboyed up and go out and push some ghosts around. That's kind of what it's turned into in a pop culture sense, as far as I can see.
It certainly has. And when I sit down and I speak with ghost hunters and I put that kind of logic like what I was talking about, here's what the trick is. Yeah. If you're going to call yourself a skeptic like I do, don't be a jackass. Don't be rude to people. So many skeptics, and I'm shaking my finger in the air as I'm saying this, so many skeptics are not truly people who withhold judgment in the absence of facts and proceed when there are logical arguments, evidences, and furthermore proofs that can be applied to something before an assumption is made. No, no, no. A skeptic, and as a matter of fact, who tends to be a doubter, in the classical sense, the skeptic was a person who philosophically felt that they could never truly attain any actual knowledge. And I do maintain that that is true to an extent, because what can we really know about reality when it is filtered through the limited perceptions of a human being?
Agreed.
And that's the thing, is if we were dealing with an alien life form from another planet, in all likelihood, their levels of perception and their sensory their abilities to sense things in their environment and aspects of their perceptual reality would differ from ours. So what can you really ever know? But I don't think that a skeptic is a person that needs to be an irate confrontationalist and a person who is one who is predisposed toward debunking. I don't believe, and I'm going to go into this knowing I'm going to disprove you no matter what the evidence entails. That, too, is its own form of pseudoscience. We have to find that radical common center ground where we can ask the hard questions but not discount anything else based on either a preconception or a predisposition either for or against whatever phenomena we're hoping to learn about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I try to maintain a neutral stance when I am investigating, anytime I'm talking to people. I definitely like to hear everybody out. I like to hear what they have to say, and I'm not really prone to shooting down people's concepts.
Yeah, what good are you? You're not actually helping.
I mean, I don't know.
Go ahead.
But I think it's good to be skeptical. I mean, I don't have a problem with it, but yeah, there are a lot of skeptics out there. But
yes.
It's good to be a nice skeptic, but I do believe in UFO research and people. They're very quick to think every fart in the sky is ET phone home, and that's just ridiculous in this day. Of course, I believe some of them are from personal experience, but people out there, I swear, if they see one thing in the sky, it's the Ashtar Command sending them a message from planet Zanzibar. And that they're ushering in the new consciousness of the light worker hoo ha woo hoo wah or whatever. I'm still waiting on that one, right?
I mean, I've definitely experienced tons of things that I feel are outside of the realm of what is considered normal. You know, as far as what's outside of the realm of psychology. You know, like what we understand. And I mean, I'm not a true believer Kool-Aid type, but I'm willing to accept ideas, especially when there's so much, theory and hypothesis like thrown at me, you know, and then in analyzing all that stuff and making comparisons, you know, I come to my own conclusions.
Absolutely, and you have to. That's the whole thing. Is I think that there's a healthy way of applying logic and science to what you're trying to understand without having to detract from the belief or even the enjoyment of others. Again, you know, with Reynolds Mansion, it's definitely a book that is written in a popular style, and even though my inherent skepticism comes out throughout the book, I think that there are probably some science types that would pick up the book and say, this is rubbish. There's, you know, he doesn't cite the sources properly, and he doesn't do this, and he doesn't do that. Well, obviously, it was more of a journalistic take, and yes, I color the text with my own perceptions of the phenomenon or the lack thereof often. And I'll tell you this, I'm not going to lie to you and say that I've seen ghosts at Reynolds Mansion. I haven't seen ghosts, nor have I seen evidence of anything that would be considered apparitional, although I have had some interesting experiences which have played on, I think, my own psychological disposition at the outset of going into the home and thinking initially, okay, here I am in a haunted house. And so, you know, on those terms, it's interesting, and I've learned at times a few things from my experiences there in relation to how I think that the nature of a haunting often has less to do with a physical apparition or a manifestation and more to do with the perception of the individual. But then again, that seems to be the underlying theme with all paranormal phenomena, that really, whatever so much of it is, it seems to be something, an experience filtered through the perception of the individual.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, how else are we going to experience it, you know, without having it being filtered through our consciousness?
Absolutely.
I mean, how else are we supposed to interpret it? I mean, like a lot of people, I mean, I've really immersed myself into these ideas, and and I've definitely seen a lot of strange things, and I don't have any answers, you know.
Yeah,
you know, I only have ideas, you know.
Well, that's the thing.
Well, hey guys, it's we're getting down to the last few minutes, so I just want to make sure that we mentioned New Page Books, and what is their actual link, Mike? Is it newpagebooks.com or is it something else?
Newpagebooks.com will get you to the website. They're the suppliers of all kinds of fantastic reading material. And, of course, Nick Redfern, another friend of your program and a friend of mine, he's got, actually he's working on a couple more installments of his MIB series there, and they'll be coming out through New Page just as well. And there's a lot of other different fine titles that you can check out. Scotty Roberts' new book, which is the this infamous tome of knowledge. I've got my copy right here. It's the Secret History of the Reptilians. So, yeah, that's New Page Books and what they do in their fine edit, and they were gracious enough to bring the UFO Singularity to a large audience, and so you can find them out at newpagebooks.com.
Awesome.
Yeah, and there's a dedication to me in UFO Singularity, Jeffrey Muffin Man Pritchett. Which
it sure is.
My first dedication.
Was it really your first?
Yeah, pretty epic.
Highly deserved. Like, did you think I was not going to mention you in the book, dude?
I don't really even look for that kind of stuff. You told me, and I looked, and I don't even normally I'll skim the dedication stuff and just read the book, but I don't really like pay big attention to it. But when you told me, and I actually said, really? And I had to go back and look. Because it's not something I go around saying, oh, did Micah dedicate his book to me? You know, something like that. Yeah.
Applications and more books, maybe more people have actually dedicated them to you.
Yeah, I know, right? I need to check all the books. By the end of 2013, I'll be in four books. So
yes, well, be pretty cool.
Awesome. Just my articles and stuff. But, anywho, and what about your other book, the Reynolds Mansion book? Where can we get that?
That one's available on Amazon.com. It's a regional seller around here, so if you live in the Asheville, North Carolina area, you can also find it at the Reynolds Mansion Bed and Breakfast, which I have to recommend as well. Just Google that Reynolds Mansion Bed and Breakfast, Asheville, North Carolina, and you'll be able to find that. It's a beautiful place and well worth going and checking out just as well. But if you want to find the book, it's available on Amazon.com or at my website, www.graliereport.com.
Awesome.
All righty, and how about the Graalian Report, your radio show?
Ah, that's right, of course. I do a radio show, damn it. Yeah, that's the podcast and radio. Radio is live every Tuesday from 8 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. Eastern. If you want to, you know, being live, you can download the podcast. It's available through iTunes and all the podcatching clients. And, of course, again, at graalianreport.com. You can come and check it out and listen. You know, we have a lot of different kinds of guests and not always the same people that show up on all the other paranormal shows, you know. And, you know, we had a couple of weeks ago Dr. Maxim Kammerer, brilliant philosopher, you know, linguist, physicist, everything. He's an intelligent gentleman. And really blew everybody's minds. Father Jack Ashcraft had come on the program and dropped the bomb about how he thought that there was all this stuff going on in the Vatican. Well, boom, Pope resigns. Now, this was, of course, the day that the Pope had resigned, but now we've heard this story about a supposed dossier being released that talks about a sex scandal inside the Vatican and all this other information. So, yeah, we've been really trying to work on bringing a very interesting alternative perspective toward news with the Graalian Report. So people who listen to that, and it's going to be like all your favorite news shows, except without all the crap. We get right to the all meat, right, of the argument, and deal with the weird stuff.
Cool.
The meat and potatoes. And, of course, you're going to be returning on the 16th to help me co-host with Scott Allen Rabbit. Scott Allen Roberts. I'm tired. And Secret of Reptilians, and hopefully we can make him talk about Exodus a little bit, too, with that Dr. Ward dude. So we'll have to make him talk about that a little bit. Thanks for doing the show, Micah,
yeah.
And it's always a pleasure. And as we leave, Beazle, give your link out for your show.
Yeah, just check out the Electric Eye Radio Show on Facebook, the Electric Eye Radio Show page. Just go like that. Check it out. The show comes on every Friday from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. on Insight Radio. So Check it out.
All right, Micah and Beazle, we appreciate it, and yeah, we'll be in touch, and everybody stay out of trouble, and hopefully I don't get my wiener cut off tonight, so pray for me to the alien shamans. I know, me neither.
Good luck, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Micah, I appreciate it. It was really educational for me.
Good to meet you, Beazle. Yeah, both of you guys. I'll have to listen to your show next time, too, okay?
Yeah, check it out.
Most definitely will.
We need to stop by his show. You should hook up. He's on my friend's thingy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, or find me, or vice versa. I'll find you, or you find me, and let's definitely do that.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to do that. So
okay. Anytime. Standing invitation. I'll invite myself.
Yeah, just call me.
All right.
All right, man.
All right. Sweet dreams, sweetheart. Good night, princes of paranormal. Good night.
Good night.
Very well.
Parties. Good night.
Oh Lord.
Bye bye. Jim Mars next week. That's right, rock it with your cockatoo. Good night.